And now, back to brainstorming with Billy.
A perfectly good brain wasted.
Now, here's your host, Billy the Brain.
Welcome back. This is Bill Frank, and you're listening to Brainstorming with Billy the Brain here on KKZZ, Positive Talk Radio for Ventura and Santa Barbara counties. Every show has a theme, and today's theme is Trailblazers. Each of my guests is a trailblazer in his area of expertise. My next guest is named by Newsweek as one of the 50 people who matter most on the Internet. He's a thinker, a writer, a columnist, and he's going to give us a recipe to be more innovative from his book, The Innovator's Cookbook. And if you have a question or if you want to join in the conversation, you can call us at 639-0008. Stephen Johnson is the best-selling author of 7 books on the intersection of science, technology, and personal experience. His latest book is titled The Innovator's Cookbook, Essentials for Inventing What Is Next. Stephen's writings have influenced everything from the way political campaigns use the Internet to cutting-edge ideas in urban planning to the battle against 21st century terrorism. Stephen is a contributing editor for Wired Magazine and a monthly columnist for Discovered Magazine. He's a distinguished writer in residence at the New York University Department of Journalism. He is also the co-founder and editor-in-chief of Feed, the revolutionary web magazine blending technology, science, and culture with a truly innovative interface. In addition to his columns, he's published in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, The Nation, and many other periodicals. He's also appeared on high-profile television programs like The Charlie Rose Show, The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, and The News Hour with Jim Lehrer. Joining us from Northern California. Hi, Stephen. How are you today? Welcome back to the show.
Hey, it's good to be back.
Well, thank you so much for returning. And want to take a look at your book, because innovation is really the key to our success as individuals and as a country. The good news is that thanks to a lot of research over the past few decades, we now know a great deal about the rules and the patterns and the strategies that lead to innovative environments. But I ask you, why are some companies like Apple, for instance, brilliant at coming up with breakthrough products and services while others are not?
Well, it has a lot to do with both the kind of the culture, the leadership, and the physical environment. I mean, one of the big themes of this book, and in fact my last book, Where Good Ideas Come From, which I think we talked about
a couple months ago,
is sometimes just the physical architecture of the environment makes a big difference. And we can get into that in more detail. But I think the biggest thing that is a kind of recurring theme of all the conversations and essays in the new book and what I wrote in the last one is that innovative environments are about the collision or the intersection point between different perspectives, different worldviews, different fields of expertise. And Apple, throughout its history, has had that happen. If you look at the beginning of Apple, the thing that made that company so revolutionary in 1976, 1977, and the thing that was so important in the history of kind of Steve Jobs' personal life, is that it was at the intersection point of kind of high-tech Silicon Valley and the academic environment of Stanford and Berkeley in the Bay Area, and then the counterculture. It was a huge part of Apple's early history is influenced by the fact that the counterculture was so prominent in the Bay Area, and the way in which Steve Jobs was influenced by people like Stuart Brand, who's actually my neighbor now.
Really?
it was those kind of three different things coming together that made Steve Jobs who he was and made the company who it was. And then later on in his life, right, actually one of the last slides he ever showed before he died in one of his, kind of product announcements, was he showed this kind of street sign that showed the intersection of liberal arts and technology. And he said that's what Apple has always been about. It's about not just about tech for tech's sake. It's not just engineers. It's about people who understand art and design and poetry and music who are then using technology or getting involved in technology to advance those interests. And it was that kind of diversity of interest that has made that company so innovative.
Well, not to make this a Steve Jobs love fest, but you did write when Steve Jobs stepped down for health reasons in the Wall Street Journal. You said the genius of famous innovators and CEOs is often exaggerated. Most fortunes are built on good fortune as much as sheer brilliance, and the invention is a collaborative art. But there is no contesting the fact that Steve Jobs is genius, just a debate about the defining quality. So you sort of eulogized him as he stepped down from his position there as being one of the leading thought leaders in really in technology today. So let's come back to this if we can. Ideas are almost always triggered by some provocative collision, as you just said, between two existing ideas. Last time you were on the show, you gave us the 7 strategies for making those collisions happen, which was interesting. How do successful companies and organizations create environments that support your 7 strategies for innovation?
Well, I'll tell you, one of the stories that's in the new book comes from Tom Kelly, who is one of the folks that's been running IDEO, one of the most innovative companies in the world as well. And the Innovators Cookbook has a bunch of these conversations with kind of innovators at work, is what we call it, basically. And one of the things that Tom told me about IDEO is that for the last 20 years, every Monday morning at the senior management meeting, when they get together for that kind of key meeting at the beginning of the week where the top people all, you know, talk about what's going on, what the latest contracts are, what the big projects are, they have started that meeting with 15 minutes of show and tell. And all the top brass, and they get together, and one of them says, hey, look at this cool robotic toy that my 7-year-old brought home yesterday, or I went to this art opening this weekend, and I saw this painting. I thought this was amazing. Check this out. And Tom says that, you know, it's funny. He says, you know, from a distance, it's indistinguishable from kindergarten. But what it does is that it sets this expectation, because this is right at the, you know, most important meeting of the week and with the most important people in the company, and it sets this expectation that the interesting ideas are going to come from these surprising connections and these serendipitous discoveries. It's not just going to come from sitting alone in your cubicle and trying to think a big idea or have a brainstorm session. It's going to come from somebody coming in and saying, what if we learned something from this crazy new toy we found? What would happen if we applied that to that car we're helping to design? And it's that kind of surprise and playfulness, really, that is such a key element that companies and organizations need if they're going to be innovative.
All right. Well, look, I like that example. I like the IDEO get-together where they look at different projects, different toys and things like that. Let's use an example from your own life. Trace your personal evolution using computer organizing tools from Apple's HyperCard to DevonThink to your current product findings. And first of all, describe them all and then explain the connections there.
Yeah, I'm glad you asked about that. Yeah, so ever since I got a Mac, basically, I've been, you know, which I got when I first got to college in 1986, and I've been kind of obsessed with using the technology to, in a sense, to extend my memory, to keep track of all the things that I've read and to help me make connections between all these, all the books that I've read or articles that I've read and things like that. And so in 87 or 88, Apple came out with this thing called HyperCard, which was in some ways, you know, a kind of prototype of the web in that it had a lot of hypertext. You could kind of click on a word and jump to another card. It wasn't a network thing, but you could move through the information somewhat like the way we move through web pages. And I just got obsessed with this, and so I tried to build this whole elaborate tool to keep track of all my notes for college. And I got so obsessed with it that I kind of stopped going to classes. So I didn't have any notes to organize because I was just working on this note-taking tool. That, you know, ended up not really going anywhere. But, you know, the idea stuck in my mind. And then, I don't know, about 15 years later, I found this wonderful piece of software called DevonThink. And I started putting all the quotes from every book that I'd read ever that I found influential. I'd kind of type them up or scan them in and put them in this research tool. And it would let me make these kind of interesting connections between a piece of text. So I'd grab one quote from one book, and the software could show me other quotes that were kind of similar to it. And so it became this way of making new connections, although it's all filtered through stuff that I had read and selected and curated, basically. So it was a way of kind of using the software to kind of riff through my own memory. And I've got many, many good ideas and interesting connections have come out of using that. And then about a year ago, I started working with these wonderful folks at a company called BetaWorks in New York City on this project called Findings, which is an attempt to do that same kind of quote memory triggering system on the web and to do it in a social way. And so if you sign up for Findings, which I encourage people to do, it's just out of beta just a couple of weeks ago, you can grab quotes from around the web, you can grab quotes that you've selected from your Kindle if you're reading an ebook, and they'll be stored on the web, but you can also go and see what other people are reading. and kind of look over other people's shoulders as they're reading and selecting quotes and things like that, and make connections or buy books that you find interesting from their quotes and things like that. And so it's this version of a kind of a reading journal that's social in public in a certain way that was very hard to do before the web came along. It's a lot of fun.
All right. My guest is Stephen Johnson. He's author of the brand new book, The Innovator's Cookbook, Essentials for Inventing What Is Next. And let's come back to the book if we can, Stephen, because in the book you talk about a lot of different rules and things, which is great. But more often than not, companies themselves kill off innovation through their structures and their practices. What are some of the key ways that companies actually impede what they desire most, innovation?
I think the biggest single way is it's the kind of the curse of the org chart, right? And departments. So you say, okay, all the marketing people, you live here and only talk to other marketing people. And engineers, you're over there in this special engineering industrial design office. And finance people, you're over here, right? And that makes sense in a kind of factory kind of sense of things. Like, it's a lot clearer and more legible if you group people by the kind of work they do and just put them in their slots. But as we've said, you know, the most interesting kind of spaces for innovation are diverse spaces, not kind of multiculturally diverse spaces, although that can be helpful too, but diverse spaces in terms of people coming at a problem from different perspectives. And so what you want to be able to do is create environments where the marketing people can talk to the sales people, who can talk to the engineering people, who can talk to the product people, who can talk to the, and create these little hubs where there are lots of different kind of perspectives converging on the same problem. And so, you can still have a traditional org chart, you can still have traditional departments, but you want to facilitate interactions between all these different people and make it a lot easier for them to cross borders or get out of their silos.
Well, that certainly makes a lot of sense. You've also got something in there that I found interesting just by the term was intriguing. You have something called innovation blowback from disruptive management. What do you mean by that?
Well, I'm trying to remember. That's in, I think, John Seely Brown's essay, yeah. And you know, it's partially this, there's you know, a lot of question about when you come up with kind of new ideas and new products and new categories and things like that, you often end up with this problem where you you don't know exactly what the consequences are going to be. And that's a part of the power of disruptive innovation, but it's also the kind of danger of it, right? You come up with something new and it ends up coming back to bite you in some kind of way. So there is this kind of, that's one of the reasons why companies choose to not be innovative, because they're just afraid. Like, it's this, you know, this they understand their business in a certain way, they understand their product, they're making money, and they don't want to change. This is the innovator's dilemma, because they're making money. And if they change, well, it involves risk, it involves chance, it involves the possibility that, you know, this thing we're inventing is going to come back and turn out to be, you know, much more useful for our competitors or put us at a competitive disadvantage. And so you have to manage that. It's not like it's an easy thing to do.
No, it is definitely not. My guest is Stephen Johnson. And Stephen, in the book, you do interviews with what you call innovators at work. I love that term. One of the people that you interviewed was Ray Ozzie, who is the former head of Microsoft's software architect for Microsoft. He was also the inventor of Lotus Notes. Talk to me about that interview. What did you learn from him about innovation?
Well, he's a really interesting guy, and I've known him kind of on and off for many years. So it was fun to kind of sit down and talk to him about his process. And one of the things he talks about is just the importance of literally getting disoriented, in terms of where he has some of his best ideas. So he talks about loving to go really liking to go to a new city and just, like, take the subway around the city and get lost. And something about kind of walking around the streets, riding subways, not really sure where we were going, it just triggers new ideas. And I think it's partially that you have a lot of kind of extended time to yourself, where your mind is kind of free to wander and you're not just answering emails or checking your Facebook feed. But you're surrounded by new stimulus. And so you're surrounded by new faces, new buildings, new environments. And that combination of long periods of time alone in your own thoughts, coupled with new external stimulus, is a really powerful kind of combination. I love that idea, right? And I've always kind of noticed that about myself too, but I hadn't quite put it on word, in words, so it was great to hear it from him.
Good. My guest is Stephen Johnson, the author of the book, The Innovator's Cookbook, Essentials for Inventing What Is Next. Stephen, what do you want people to take away from reading your book, The Innovator's Cookbook?
Well, I think it's that innovation is not just this kind of magic thing that you have to be a genius to be able to do, and that we do understand how it works on many levels, and there are a lot of kind of concrete steps that you can take that I talk about both in Where Good Ideas Come From and the Innovator's Cookbook, that you can make your organization or just your own personal life more creative in terms of the ideas that you have. But you just have to kind of, it's not like it's pure self-help, it's not like it's a, do these six things and you'll be innovative, but I think that there are a set of strategies out there that can push you in that direction.
Very good. My guest has been Stephen Johnson. Stephen, if people are intrigued by what they hear, they want to learn more about you, learn more about the book, where would you direct them to go on the internet?
Oh, I mean, I'm at StephenBerlinJohnson.com, Berlin like the city in Germany, which is my middle name, and I'm at Stephen B. Johnson on Twitter, and I'm constantly blogging and tweeting about these things.
All right, that is great, Stephen. Thank you so much for being my special guest here on Brainstorming with Billy the Brain. We'll talk to you down the road.
Great.